I'm sorry, I didn't think my voice would be betraying so much emotion. I did, you know, maybe I would have elected to do differently this morning, but bear with me. I'm sorry for imposing that on you. Not that I'm sorry to share a great grief, but I expected to be more composed. I'll just comment this much farther. I was just thinking this week and discussing with Ellen, and this is just a good observation of life to bring to Scripture and bring to what the Lord promises and does not promise. That, you know, we look at life very often as the Lord blesses, the Lord withholds blessing as He sees fit. He is sovereign, He is good. But we were reflecting on the fact that blessings are all elective in a sense. There's nothing that God gives us as a blessing that we may feel certain will happen. We cannot look down the road of life and even to our next breath. There's not one blessing upon which we can certainly depend. They're all God's providential goodness. This is speaking temporally, by the way, of course. When I say blessings, I'm speaking of temporal blessings. None of them are certain. Not one. Tragedy is certain. And we need to live our lives in light of that. You know, I think I'm guilty. Again, you know, blessings, tragedies, temporally speaking, of course. Because eternally speaking, God does nothing but bless His people. But temporally speaking, all of the blessings are things that we should be surprised and overwhelmed by at God's generosity. The tragedies, those are certain. Those are coming. We don't know which ones, but we certainly know death. We certainly know the effects of sin, and it's just interesting and I think helpful to look at life in that light. Because the trials will come, but God is sufficient. And His joy is pervasive and sufficient in those certain trials. So, with that in mind, think of Daniel. Think of the covenant people of Israel and the times of the book of Daniel. And he's receiving this vision, and we have already talked at some length about what I understand to be the fulfillment of the prophecy that Daniel is receiving in Daniel chapter 11, where we see Alexander the Great's armies marching through the Mediterranean world and into the Middle East, and his untimely death then split his kingdom. And we have the names of the four kings that were split. We are mostly occupied with these two. Ptolemy, who was the first king of the Ptolemaic succession of kings, who were centered in Egypt, and Seleucus, who was likewise the head of the Seleucid line or succession of kings, which were in Syria. Israel is caught right between. We've talked about some of that conflict. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies going after one another, their borders, they're running into conflict. This is not a friendly, you know, these aren't a couple of, you know, co-brothers that, you know, we were all together under Alexander and now we're going to live happily together. They fight bitterly against each other. We've looked at some of the specific fulfillments. As one nation attacks the other, and we've seen even those references to daughters that are in league, there's political alliances even in marriage, and we've seen that fulfilled in history. If you start with me, beginning at verse 21, this is after Antiochus the Great has been at work in history. And I'm just going to read some of what we were through last week for context and kind of get to what I think the core of the issue in the text that is left before us is. Verse 21, in his place, in the place of the one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, apparently a reference to Israel. That one had been destroyed, but not in battle. In his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. I think that's a reference to the covenant that is referred to in the previous verse. For he shall come up and be strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peacefully even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. So the king of the south and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil. And they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices, and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Then he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. We're going to pause there for a second and just make some observations. this without going into great historical details. There's not 100%, but a fairly broad agreement among evangelical scholars who have studied this, that this conflict, this exalting of self above all gods, even gods that his own forebears would have known, is referring to Antiochus the IV, known as Epiphanes. We've already referred to him, who exalted himself, and the main conflict that the Jewish nation is caught between is between this Seleucid king of the north in Syria, from Syria, and the Ptolemaic kingdom in the south. And there's meetings between them, there's deceit between them, there was a covenant referred to having to do with covenants that were made between them and with other nations that were deceitful and helpful to neither. They were both bent on evil. As far as the Jews are concerned, Antiochus Epiphanes just had immense contempt for the Jews. And as he was marching through their land, coming back from Egypt and settled there, and the Seleucids were in power over the Jews. Antiochus, we know historically, defiled the temple most deliberately. It was a deliberate slap in the face of the Jews that he set up an idol in the temple to be worshipped. This, which I think, is a reference to this god of fortresses, this god which he had sort of chosen, and it was different than even the traditions of the Greeks or the Seleucids. He sort of, you know, chose his own god, so to speak, erected an image in the temple and commanded it to be worshipped, knowing that it would defile the temple. He sacrificed a pig on the altar, knowing that that would be demoralizing to the Jews, and he didn't just have in mind demoralizing, but like invalidating what's referred to in that passage as the Holy Covenant. I'm going to defile your temple. I'm going to make it useless to you. I'm going to sacrifice an unclean animal. He also, in the temple, there were, and you know, put yourself back in the days before printing presses, when to have the scriptures copied out would have been a very precious, very labor-intensive thing. He took the temple scriptures and destroyed, burned the temple scriptures. This was all done with a view to humiliate, insult, demoralize, undermine the Jews. Keep in mind, the broader history is that through all the depredations, even starting with the Babylonian captivity, which we've read quite a bit about, God had providentially kept the Jews able to maintain their own identity when the normal course, when the normal path that kingdoms took in those days was to subjugate cultures. And, you know, every battle was not just a battle of nation against nation. It was my God's bigger than your God, is the way I used to say it to my fourth graders all the time. So you have this history of cultures, not just nation, not political entities, but cultures trying to subjugate one another. And with a considerable amount of success, the Jews were not subjugated culturally. They maintained their own distinct identity under the Babylonians. When they returned from the Babylonian captivity, they were under the Persians, and yet they were allowed to have their temple and their city and their own measure of self-government providentially. And in the context of the history of the times, that was really exceptional. Alexander the Great comes in, same thing. As he is impressed with the prophecy, we talked about the elders going out to meet him, and he is impressed and allows the high priests to maintain under him. There's no question Alexander conquered Israel, but the high priests were allowed a measure of self-government. Again, the Jews are allowed to maintain a measure of self-government, maintain their own system of worship, even in spite of Alexander's greater program of Hellenization, where he is enforcing Greek cultures and the Greek language on all of the nations that he conquers. And the Israelites generally, not exclusively, there's some holdouts that keep communicating from one generation to another. We're going to speak Hebrew. We're going to really try to be the purest of Jews. But a lot of Israelites ended up being Greek speaking. And that accounts for us opening our New Testaments after all this has happened. And in the New Testament, Israel, as Jesus appears on the scene, they're speaking Greek and Aramaic. And then we run into the book of Acts. If you recall some of our study in the book of Acts, that there's even a clash that comes up later, both inside and outside the church, between the Hebrew-speaking Israelites who consider themselves the purists and the Hellenized Israelites who still consider themselves faithful and were sacrificing at the temple. But this is all coming out of this period of history. So Antiochus Epiphanes is a pretty significant figure in the shaping of the Jewish culture coming into the days when Christ will appear in the fullness of time. God brought forth his son, born of a woman, to redeem his people. And it seems that this prophecy is very much pointing to what's going to happen to Israel heading for those times. The end of the chapter is where it gets controversial, shall we say. And it leads right into chapter 12, so I'm sure Ray will do an excellent job filling in blanks that I leave unfilled. There is a shift as you read, and like I said, I'm referring to some fairly broad agreement, not complete consensus among evangelicals about this representing Antiochus the Fourth. But there's a shift, and you can't even really tell where exactly, but somewhere verse 38, 39, 40, 41, the things that are being spoken of start heading towards, and remember, this is, chapter divisions are artificial constructs. They weren't in the original scriptures. So it's heading towards part of the same vision. It doesn't stop at the end of chapter 11. It goes on to chapter 12. And Ray, to trespass on your material a little bit, you have to look at what this is heading for. The south and the north, the kings of the south and the north are still in conflict. Verse 41, we read through verse 40, he shall enter the glorious land, many countries shall be overthrown, these shall escape, Edom, Moab, the prominent people of Ammon, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, the land of Egypt shall not escape, he shall have power over treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. At that time, now refer back to verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south. Okay, so we have this reference to the time of the end. We have, again, the reference to the time that is contemporary to this prophecy in chapter 12. The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. I'm sorry, Michael shall arise, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. At that time your people should be delivered. Everyone who is found written at the book, it talks about those in verse 2, those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. wow, big shift here. So we're not necessarily talking about Antiochus Epiphanes anymore, although there is a view that, yes, we are. Some people still take the position that, and I'm going to kind of just diagram the options very simply. Try to leave the Mediterranean world up there. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies are the kingdoms. Remember, the king of the south and the king of the north. I'm going to pause for a second before I go on because I was ignoring Newton's hand. Go ahead, Newton. Right.
And I noticed that in my edition of the New King James, there is a paragraph that begins in 36. So that might support a change at that point.
Right.
They would say that the it's talking about now the beast or the antichrist.
Right. Yeah, which gets to our interchange last week, Keith, which... My principle is going to be we want to have an eschatological systematic theology discussion. It's a different lesson. I want to stick with this text. There's some things I'm not certain about. But rather than say, oh, we know, and therefore this must mean because we know it's about the Antichrist, you know, what I want to do is proceed from this text and just talk about how it has been interpreted. Could leave you to draw some of your own conclusions and leave Ray to draw some conclusions as he goes through chapter 12. Yes, Tim. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, there's I'm not. Right. Right. I certainly don't know the answer. I have even my opinion. I'll give you some of what I have settled on as an opinion, but it's pretty loosely held at this point. Basically, the main two, well, the main division to start with is, I'll just, Antiochus Epiphanes the IV, this is all about him, or it's about some, excuse me, I can't even spell. It is about some future, and I won't even say king, I'll say reign, although you can supply the word king there if you want. If it's about Antiochus Epiphanes the IV, then the language is highly symbolic. You have... And I'm not going to get into too much into detail because this is where I myself am not firmly ensconced in a camp. But you would say things like this: when Antiochus Epiphanes the IV is acting against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, this is all about him exalting himself. When he is interfered with as he overthrows the glorious land, but there is the Libyans and the Ethiopians following at his heel. I just lost my place where it talks about the ships from Cyprus interfering with his thank you. Verse 40? 30. Yeah, the ships of Cyprus shall come against him. That's pretty well agreed upon that has happened, but there's also this idea of other armies coming against him, and it's a reference to not just him, but him as representative of the Seleucid kingdom. And later on, Rome is extending its influence as Rome grows into the most powerful nation seen in history up until that time. And so there's a third party introduced into the picture in the conflict between the kings of the north and the kings of the south. Before I go any farther on this, also keep in mind that you have up in verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out exploits. And it talks about this conflict where it's in the context of people who know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And that's generally taken to refer to the Maccabean rebellion. You know, Antiochus Epiphanes defiles the temple and the Jewish people. There's a leader, Judas Maccabees, who says, if they wipe us out to the last man, we're not putting up with that. And there is this rebellion, and against considerable odds, it is successful. And the Seleucids are driven out of the land, and there is a brief period of history where the Jews, under elders and high priests, but priests that are descended from the Maccabees, who are not of the tribe of Judah, they reign, and so Israel has this self-government, but even that is controversial, even among the Israelites, because some Israelites took the position at that time, we have no business rebelling, this is all still under God's providential hand of discipline, and we are waiting for the Messiah. And so historically, you have this division of the Jews about exactly how theologically we should understand even our own rebellion against this evil king. It's prophesied, you know, we're rising up and doing exploits, the people who know their God. But at the same time, there are Jews saying it stops there. We're not to be reestablishing a king because we are waiting for the Messiah. We are waiting for the king. This isn't a path that we should follow. And without going into detail, but it's just helpful to kind of have the big picture, differences over how to understand the Jews' own responsibilities and privileges under God's providence gives birth to these warring parties, which we meet anew in the New Testament, of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the different parties, because you know, we read the New Testament and they're restrained by Rome's law, but we see them sort of as rival factions, maybe like Republicans and Democrats. It's not that at all. They hate each other bitterly over deeply held theological positions about what is appropriate for the Jews to do, what's really the best course if we are reestablishing ourselves as a kingdom. And there is civil war and there are massacres. It is not Democrats and Republicans. Yet, I was just about to say, yet. It's not that big of a stretch to think it could come to that, I suppose. But you know, keep that when you're reading about the divisions between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the party who believe in the resurrection and the party who deny a resurrection, keep in mind that this isn't just an intramural squabble about a theological point. These are deeply held, bitterly fought positions, and they hated each other. And their common hatred of the Messiah appearing in history is a unifying factor, such as they hadn't seen for a long time in history. But anyway, that's all part of the picture under Antiochus Epiphanes. As you get into these later verses, past verse 36 or verse 40, depending on where you see the break coming, Newton suggests 36, and I don't have any reason to differ with him. If it's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, it has to be talking not about things that we've specifically seen in history, but sort of an era, the kinds of things that happened, stretching out his hands against the countries in verse 42. It might also be talking about succeeding authorities from Antiochus Epiphanes, not him personally, by the way, it's an important note to notice, all through this chapter, we're not seeing this king, then this king. It just says the king. And the king of the north, the king of the south, in the language that Scripture's using, seems not to be representing personal rulers, but kingdoms. I've already erased it. The Ptolemies are the king of the south, and there's successive Ptolemaic kings, but the phrase that keeps coming up in the prophecy is the king of the south. So it's not necessarily anywhere along here only talking about one king personally. It's the kingdoms. Same thing with the king of the north, the kingdom of the Seleucids. Go ahead, Newton. Right.
They were extremely violent, even more so than any of the other parties that I'm aware of. And that certainly would be, what you said would be true for them.
Right. Certainly would be true in Roman times. They were the ultimate pragmatists, the zealots. Anything to throw off the yoke. Any end of throwing off the yoke of foreign domination justifies the means. Murder, conspire, anything. They're ultimate pragmatists. As long as we're staying in that thread, there's one other thing worth considering. Historically, not a whole lot is known about the Essenes. We have the Pharisees, the Sadducees. A third considerable minority was the Essenes, who we mostly know about because of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was an Essene sect that preserved the Dead Sea Scrolls, which has given us a lot of light on the history and on the scriptures. The Essenes we don't know much about historically because their theological view seems to have led, and I say seems to, I'm kind of drawing my own conclusion here, that, you know, I think a lot of historians agree with this. Their view was nobody's doing the right thing in this whole mess. We're just withdrawing from society. We're going out to the hills. We're going to stay away from the kings. We're going to stay away from the Pharisees. We're going to stay away from the Sadducees. We're going to stay away from all the descendants of the Maccabees. None of them are right. We are going out and waiting for the Messiah and keeping the temporal society at arm's length. Hence, there's not a lot of history written about them because they're very isolated and they're very uninfluential in the written history of the times. We don't know how many there were, but there's some reasons to believe that that was a considerable movement. So you take that for what it's worth. But we have all these competing theologies at work in the intertestamental period leading up to Christ. Go ahead. Yeah. Right. Well, I haven't got there yet. If you take this position that this is all Antiochus Epiphanes, then you're talking about the end of chapter 40, the end of chapter 11 through verse 45, and going into chapter 12. It starts to be very symbolic language, and you can interpret things such as this as you go into chapter 12. At that time, your people shall be delivered. Oh, that's referring to the Maccabean rebellion. We threw off the yoke. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. That's a figurative, language about the nation's identity and the population of the nation being resurrected from foreign domination. The language. My point is that the language has to become, if this is your position, highly figurative. Now, to answer Ray's question, if it's talking about a future king or a future reign, first of all, you've got to decide where the shift is. Again, Newton's suggesting verse 36. I've heard several propositions. I'm not settled on that. One way to read it, and we're going to run out of time, and I'm going to leave a lot of this to you, Ray, is... I will put the the word Antichrist up here, the beast, the future ruler preceding the end, and it's just strictly about him. Others would say that it's talking about a future reign, but that the whole history has in view here is the prophecy given to Daniel, and we refer to that verse. Verse 40, at the time of the end, and that language is used several times, at that time, then in verse 12. What's in view is the end of pre-Messiah Jewish history. This is what's going to happen to the nation as it fulfills its purpose and brings forth the Messiah. And then as far as Judaism is concerned, there is an end. And I'm using the indefinite article very deliberately, an end, not the end. If you take the position that that is what this whole prophecy is about, then what future kings can fit a lot of this? And this gets to be a discussion even about New Testament passages. This could be Rome. Keeping in mind that the language of the prophecy very often uses personal pronouns, definite articles, he, the king, when it seems reasonably clear, I won't lay that in concrete, but it seems reasonably clear that it's not talking about a personal king. It's talking about a kingdom. The king, he, that kind of language refers to these successors of Alexander the Great and their kingdoms succeeding one another. Yes, there's personal kings, but there's not just one king in mind. It's these kingdoms are in conflict. You could take that same idea about how the language is being used and say, as it starts talking about this latest future ruler, the king doesn't mean just one Roman emperor. It means Rome. Rome comes in, I believe it's about, 63 BC. Rome marches in and takes over Jerusalem. We read the whole, influence of Rome's reign on what happens to the Messiah. They are instrumental in the sacrifice of the Messiah. And then as history proceeds, Rome is an overarching influence on even the early spread of the gospel, as their commerce and roads are a means that God's providence uses in that. And then what you might say, referring to an end, is the Jews' place as a nation, which has been providentially preserved for many generations in 70 AD as their Messiah is rejected, is cut off. And the temple is destroyed and the nation is gone. There's other ways you could refer to, this could be referring to a future reign that is not finally eschatological. Even if it is referring to Rome or to some other king, there's still the idea that, how shall I draw this? Maybe not down, maybe straight across. That even though it is directly talking about Rome, it is also foreshadowing, maybe not directly saying, oh, this is what the Antichrist is going to be like, but even as Rome carries out its policies and is this oppressive power over the Jews, there are still shadows of that that look toward the final end. That would be consistent with, and I think it's very reminiscent of the language that you find in Matthew 24. And that's where you got to appeal to verse 12 a little bit. There's this time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. Well, if you're a New Testament scholar at all, that immediately brings Matthew 24 to mind, I think. What's Matthew 24 about? Well, it's the same debate, but I think reading Matthew 24, there's some things that are pretty unmistakably about Rome. And then there's a division in the chapter where things become not unmistakably about Rome, but there's a greater fulfillment which Rome represents. You may find that explanation and those options very unsatisfying, but it's 10:15, and I'm sure Ray will straighten it out for you. But my final word on the subject is we have the text. We don't have all that. We have history that's been written, but we don't know everything about history. You know, we only know what's been written. We have different theologies that are influencing our interpretation of the text. Just as I've said before, careful. You can't hold a theology and it not influence your reading of the text. But you got to be careful to let the text be in the driver's seat and let it inform your theology rather than vice versa. It's not an absolute thing. You can't only have a one-way street. If you've arrived at a conclusion, your conclusion is going to influence how you read other passages of Scripture. That's unavoidable. It's necessary. It's appropriate. But the primary task is to know the text and keep letting it inform you as your maturity in Christ grows. John, you have your hand up. I will leave that on the board for you to, if Ray doesn't erase it, for you to, you know, bring to inform this whole discussion as it goes forward. Because yes, I do think that the language of type and antitype, is going on regularly in prophecy and certainly in this whole passage. So, I didn't even get to talk about my opinion, which is perhaps for the best. But like I said, it's lightly held, loosely held. No other hands. I anticipated being early and I'm late. So thank you all.